Case number 07-7173, American Center for International Labor Solidarity, Appellant versus Federal Insurance Company. Mr. Collins for the appellant, Mr. Christensen for the appellee.
May it please the court, Jeremiah Collins for the plaintiff appellant, American Center for International Labor Solidarity, and I hope to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. The liability insurance policy at issue in this case, Your Honors, required timely notice of a claim, but unlike many policies, it explicitly stated that timely notice was not required of, quote, circumstances which could give rise to a claim. When the center received the EEOC charge that began all of this, it certainly had notice of circumstances that could give rise to a claim, but the question whether an actual claim had arisen depends on whether those EEOC proceedings constituted a formal administrative or regulatory proceeding. And under the well-established standards for construing insurance policies against the insurer, the question here is whether that language, referring to a formal administrative proceeding, is reasonably open to a construction under which what we had here was not a formal proceeding. Our submission is that
It wasn't a formal proceeding, but it was initiated by a notice of charges, correct?
It was, Your Honor.
Yes. So what's an example of a of a formal proceeding, as you see it?
As we've pointed out, where courts have used that phrase, formal administrative proceeding, they've generally referred to a proceeding that involves an evidentiary hearing. But we think the EEOC proceedings are uniquely informal for two reasons. The first is that, as this court has explained in Martini and the Supreme Court has explained in Occidental Life, the whole purpose of the EEOC administrative process is to provide what those courts characterized as an informal way to try to resolve disputes.
But they're required. They're a prerequisite to filing a lawsuit.
That's correct, Your Honor. And the lawsuit would be the formal proceeding. But the word formal can be used to refer to anything that's legally required, anything that has rules about it. But as we've noted, it's also a common dictionary definition that it refers to a particular solemn level of proceedings.
What, this is a policy. This policy covers employment-related claims, right? That's what this is for.
Yes.
And it includes claims based on racial discrimination.
That's right? Correct, Your Honor.
So what do you think paragraph 4 covers if it doesn't cover EEOC or state agency proceedings that are initiated the way this one was? I mean, if you're thinking about employment discrimination, doesn't paragraph 4 fit the EEOC perfectly? Isn't that what?
I think not, Your Honor, because meaning has to be given to the fact that the policy applies only to formal.
Well, what does 4 cover then, if it doesn't cover this?
It covers a Title VII lawsuit. It would cover a state administrative EEO proceeding that involves.
Well, but lawsuits aren't commenced by the filing of a notice of charges.
Correct. Under the language of the policy, there has to be first a notice of charges, and it has to trigger a formal proceeding. If it triggers,
right, but that's not a lawsuit.
It could be, as I was indicating, a state EEO process if it has hearings and if liability can be imposed. It would be an NLRB proceeding where there are hearings and liability can be imposed. Our position is twofold here. Not only do we say that EEOC proceedings are informal because the courts have characterized them that way, and because in this case, which is all I believe the court has to decide, the proceedings consisted of nothing but a position statement. It never could have included an evidentiary hearing. But in addition to that, a very important consideration is that the EEOC proceeding cannot result in the determination of liability or any relief. And we're dealing with a liability policy. A lot of things can happen on the way to a potential.
Could you go back and say once again what four covers? Number two is your lawsuit. Civil proceeding commenced by service of a complaint. That's a lawsuit. That's the Title VII lawsuit. So what's four? I still don't understand what role number four plays in the policy.
An example would be if an NLRB charge were filed, that triggers an evidentiary proceeding before the NLRB in which the NLRB can make determinations of liability and can impose remedies. If you had a state FEP agency that took a case and was conducting an adjudicatory hearing and could impose liability, that would be within four. But the reason we've cited the Bensalem line of cases is that although those cases would be trumped if there were clear policy language broadening the definition of a claim, they do point out that the root meaning of a claim under a liability policy is a situation where liability can be imposed.
Claim is a defined term here. I don't see how that's relevant.
Because it's defined. It's relevant for two reasons, Your Honor. It's a defined term, but defined, we would say, ambiguously. We note that several insurance companies have apparently recognized that, seen a need to clarify. But perhaps more importantly, each of the other examples, I shouldn't say examples, there are four types of, quote, claims listed in the definition. The other three all do involve situations where there has been a demand that some form of liability be imposed by the body, the adjudicatory body, on the insured, a written demand for monetary damages, civil proceeding commenced by a complaint or similar pleading, or a criminal proceeding commenced by the service of an indictment. Those are all demands for relief. The EEOC charge does not demand any relief, nor can the EEOC impose any relief. And so under the doctrines that apply to interpreting terms in a series, that's a further reason why the root meaning of claim, the common meaning of claim discussed in Bensalem, is of significance here, because each of the other instances of a claim that's laid out in the policy is of that nature. And therefore, in our view, we are the last to suggest that there is certainty about our interpretation. We simply say there's also anything but certainty in Federal's interpretation. And the doctrine that the courts have adopted to very clearly say that doubts have to be resolved against the insurer make perfect sense in that situation.
Well, but if it is ambiguous, then, I mean, the insurance company here says the interpretation that benefits the insured is their longstanding practice of covering EEOC administrative proceedings under the policy. What's the number they use? One of the affidavits says they've covered some 20,000 of these claims.
Right, and as we've noted, a few points in response to that, Your Honor.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about your response to that.
Given what we say is the ambiguity of the provision, it's not surprising that a lot of insureds would think they're entitled to coverage. It's not surprising that Federal would think it has to provide coverage, but it's noteworthy, I guess, 3 points. There's no case law to suggest that an insured is responsible for knowledge of what is alleged here to be this industry or in a particular company's interpretation. Secondly, the fact that other
it does suggest that the interpretation is not contrary to the interest of insured policyholders.
But the doctrine, there's no support's been provided, Your Honor, and we can't find any for the notion that in interpreting insurance policies in general, or for that matter in applying the contra preferendum or the adhesion contract rules in general, that one looks to the universe of potential complainants. It's a rule about resolving doubts in favor of the insured making the claim, and that may require a company to resolve doubts in favor of one insured one way and another insured another way.
Well, but in this case, it would be resolving the doubts in favor of one insured here and 20,000 insureds elsewhere.
But my submission, Your Honor, is those 20,000 under this ambiguous language may still be entitled to coverage. It's the federal has created a problem for itself with ambiguous language. It may lose both sets of cases. It should simply clarify its policy, as so many other companies have done, and then the problem goes away. But there's no rule of law that says you have to resolve, you have to come up with one universal interpretation of an ambiguous policy that will then govern. What one has to do, as I read the cases and the treatises, is interpret the policy where it's ambiguous in favor of each insured who claims to have understood it differently than the insurer is trying to.
You said you had three responses. Well, that's number one. What's two and three?
Only in passing, we note that the broker, the center's broker, who's very experienced, said he had never encountered coverage of EEOC charges. He also did testify he hadn't encountered denials, but it's not a situation where the center or where brokers generally have universal knowledge that federals interpret its policy this way. I see I've got 20 seconds left for rebuttal.
Well,
if there are no further questions.
Give you a minute for rebuttal, Mr. Cummins. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. Wallace Christensen, counsel for Federal Insurance Company. As the court correctly noted at the outset, this is an insurance policy that is designed to provide coverage for employment practices. It is designed specifically to provide coverage for wrongful acts arising out of alleged discrimination, wrongful discharge, retaliation, violations of Title VII. And the policy, as the court knows, specifically defines what the term claim means. So the question here is not whether the word claim is ambiguous, because the term is defined. And the clause that we're focusing on for purposes of this case is Clause 4 of the definition of claim, which says a claim means a formal administrative or regulatory proceeding commenced by the filing of a notice of charges, a formal investigative order, or a similar document. ASLS, in its argument, says that this clause is ambiguous, and under District of Columbia law, it is required to proffer what it contends is an alternative definition that would fit within this definition, and they didn't do that. They haven't done that in their brief. They haven't done that.
Well, they say it covers things like NLRB proceedings where the agency can actually issue an order, can resolve a case, whereas the EEOC doesn't have that authority.
But that's not contained in the definition itself. The definition does not in any way define what is a covered claim by the outcome of the case. It does not say, for example, in other words, if they're proffering as a definition, the concept that in order to be a claim, an administrative claim must result in a full administrative trial pursuant to the Administrative Procedure Act, that's nowhere in the policy, and it's not a fair interpretation of the policy language. The example that ASLS cites and that prompted a question from the bench during its argument is the notion that the formal administrative proceeding commenced by a notice of charge implies that there can be an informal administrative proceeding commenced by a notice of charge. And to ignore that would render the word formal to be surplusage. And the court asked for an example of an administrative proceeding commenced by a notice of charge that would be deemed informal other than what ASLS claims is this particular case. Counsel was unable to point to such an example. What the policy does and the appropriate interpretation, which is the interpretation followed by federal and all of the other insureds that have purchased this policy, is the word formal means there are innumerable formal administrative proceedings, but only a subset of those proceedings are covered by this policy. Rate-making proceedings are formal administrative proceedings. Licensing proceedings are formal administrative proceedings. Those are not covered because they don't direct the contents of the notice towards a particular respondent. What the policy says is...
Wait a minute. You're introducing another element here. Where does it say it has to be directed to a particular respondent?
Well, that's what a notice of charge is. It's identifying...
So you're not saying that's part of a claim. You're saying that's a notice of a charge.
Correct.
Okay.
And the same is true of an investigative order. This applies to a formal administrative proceeding commenced by a formal investigative order. I'm not aware of any examples where such a proceeding would result in the imposition of liability directly against the respondent in those circumstances. And one example is the case cited by the district court, the New York Stock Exchange case, which involved a formal investigation, order of investigation issued by the SEC. That investigation in and of itself does not result and cannot result in the imposition of liability against the respondent. It can result in a recommendation by the staff to the SEC that further proceedings be implemented. But nevertheless, the court found that the language, the very language at issue here, was unambiguous and applied to that circumstance.
What about a proceeding initiated by, a criminal proceeding, initiated by an information? Covered?
Well, the definition says proceeding commenced by the return of an indictment.
So an indictment is presumably a somewhat more formal proceeding or outcome than is an information, correct? Because the information doesn't go through the grand jury, correct?
It's correct that it does not go through the grand jury. But
there's a threshold of formality in that limitation that it be by indictment in that clause.
That's what the clause says.
There's a threshold in clause 22.1 because the demand for monetary damages must be in writing.
Correct.
So it seems that perhaps in each of these there's a level of formality that isn't necessarily reached at the first moment when the insured is aware of the potential liability.
That is certainly true. For example, on clause 1, an oral demand would not constitute a claim under the policy. But the only clause of the definition of claim that uses the term formal is clause 4, and it talks about formal in the context of an administrative or regulatory proceeding. As the court well knows, under District of Columbia law, the court is required to interpret a policy based on the ordinary meaning of the term formal. And virtually any dictionary definition that the court would look at defines formal to mean something in the nature of following a set of rules, procedures, or guidelines, not something that's ad hoc. And that is unquestionably the case with an EEOC notice of charge. Both by statute and by regulation, there are rules and procedures that must be followed for the processing of the charge and the resolution of the charge. ASIL's argument, I think, hinges on the notice that on the concept that this is, in their words, a liability policy. So if liability can't be imposed at the end of the proceeding, the policy shouldn't cover it. But a very significant component of this policy is that it provides coverage for defense costs and legal fees that are incurred in responding to these claims, which in many cases are the most significant costs incurred by the insured. So whether there is ultimate ability to impose liability on the insured does not determine whether there's coverage. The only notion that that is advanced by ASIL is that EEOC proceedings are informal are references to the use of informal means of conciliation after the EEOC has determined that there is reasonable cause for the charges. That does not change the nature of the proceeding itself to an informal proceeding. This court itself uses an informal mediation process in connection with most appeals, including this appeal. But the fact that there's an informal mediation attempt to resolve the case doesn't change the notion or the fact that this is a proceeding covered by rules and procedures that are standard and is therefore formal.
Is it enough that it's initiated by filling out a form to make it formal?
The EEOC or?
Anything, any proceeding. If you started by filling out a form, you're into the world of formality.
obviously the filing of a charge here begins what this court and the Supreme Court has described as a integrated multi-step enforcement process under Title VII. Filling out a form.
But I just said can't be right, though, right? Because it requires a filing of a notice of charges.
Correct.
So if there has to be a filing of a notice of charges, the fact that there's a form on which you fill it out can't be indicative that it's a formal proceeding.
If the
Then everything would be a formal proceeding if it begins with filing a notice of charges and the rest of this would be redundant.
But it's a form that has certain specific requirements. It must set forth the allegations of discrimination. It must be submitted under oath. It must be filed with the EEOC and or a state agency in order to commence the process. So it is a formal requirement to commence the process, which is thereafter governed by both statutory and regulatory prescriptions as to what can and cannot be done during
the
proceeding.
Say that again. The form that the complainant fills out to begin the process is, did you say it's supposed to be sworn?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. What else did you say about it?
It has to be filed with either the EEOC or the state agency, or it can be filed concurrently with both. It's got to set forth the nature of the claim. EEOC regulations thereafter allow the commission to require additional specifications regarding the charges that are being alleged.
So there's a certain solemnity attending the initiation of the process.
Yes, there is a certain degree of solemnity, but that in and of itself is not a necessary component of a formal proceeding. Formal means following prescribed rules and procedures.
And the reason it would be redundant of the word proceeding, then, wouldn't it? As a practical matter, any proceeding will follow the form for that proceeding.
But the clause limits the type of formal proceedings that are covered by the policy. It's only proceedings that are commenced by the filing of a notice of charges or a formal investigative order or a similar document. So simply the filing of a form to initiate some kind of a proceeding may be formal, but it may not be covered by the policy either.
Can you give us an example of that?
Of the filing of a form that
initiates a proceeding which is not covered by the policy.
I suppose it could be a form filed by a company with the Consumer Product Safety Commission, for example, questioning the compliance with a particular product to the Consumer Product Safety Commission regulations.
Okay. What's your response to Mr. Collins' response to my question about your argument that if this is ambiguous, it's relevant to look at the fact that your client has covered thousands and thousands of these claims in the past? His answer is that that's irrelevant. The question is, if it's ambiguous, our obligation is to interpret it in favor of the insured in this case.
The response to that, Judge Tatel, is this. First, the court obviously has to decide whether there is an ambiguity.
Yeah, I agree. My question was, assuming it's ambiguous.
If the court considers that there's an ambiguity on the face of the policy, then the court is permitted to look at extrinsic evidence demonstrating the party's intent as to what each party thought the policy covered. Mm-hmm. And the doctrine of reasonable expectations can be applied.
I understand all that, but what about his point that in the principle of interpretation is the proposition not just that you look at evidence of the party's intent, but that you resolve ambiguities in favor of the insured. And the insured is the insured here, not the thousands of insured in other cases.
I think where the thousands of insureds in the other cases come in is with the notion of whether it is a reasonable construction of the policy to take the position they're taking here when thousands and thousands of insureds that have purchased this policy have understood the plain and unambiguous language of the policy to afford coverage for charges of discrimination.
And we know that because they must have notified you. Is that right?
Because they have filed claims seeking coverage for these proceedings. Thousands and thousands of insureds. The only other court that's ever looked specifically at this language that we're aware of is the New York Stock Exchange court, and that court concluded that the language was unambiguous on its face.
So you're not saying then that the principle that we interpreted in favor of the insured works in your favor in this case?
No, I think
you're not saying that.
I think we do say that, Judge Teel, because the principles that have been enunciated by the D.C. Court of Appeals and other courts is that in construing exclusions to the policy, limitations on coverage, generally courts, if there's an ambiguity, will construe those narrowly, and they construe grants of coverage broadly.
Right.
The definition of claim is a grant of coverage, and therefore the court, in looking at that, should construe that broadly. Although the rule is expressed differently throughout the various cases, the principle that's drawn from those cases is that grants of coverage are construed broadly, limitations on coverage are construed narrowly.
Further questions?
No.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Christensen, no. Give Mr. Collins a minute.
Your Honor, I'll try to make two quick points. The extrinsic evidence, as Mr. Christensen calls it, of the claims of coverage of other insurers was not mentioned by the district court, and for good reason. It's not extrinsic evidence as to a mutual understanding of these parties, and it's not even solid evidence of how other people have interpreted the policy. Because
why isn't it evidence of how this insurance company has interpreted it?
It's evidence at most that this insurance company, having written ambiguous language, realizes that if a party says, we read this language to say we're covered, it's hard-pressed to deny it. Or it may think it's in its interest to choose that reading of the ambiguous language. But it doesn't shed light on our interpretation or the actual meaning. And my final point, Your Honors, Federal talks about how this is a policy about employment practices. Certainly it must cover employment discrimination issues. But as Judge Ginsburg's question about criminal proceedings brings out, this policy is full of very narrow language which Federal wants to ignore. If in this case there had been a letter saying from an attorney to ASIL saying, we think you've discriminated against our client, if it's not a demand for monetary damages, it's not a claim. If there's an internal EEO process at ASIL's, if an attorney gets involved in that on behalf of Mr. Nesbitt, that's not a claim. A grievance that could go to arbitration about discrimination, that's not a claim. The question is, an EEOC charge, which is a necessary precursor to a claim in court, but which neither involves proceedings with any real trappings of formality, nor can impose any liability, is that a claim? Or in this whole list of things that can come up to raise discrimination issues, is it not reasonably open to say that the claim is when the proceeding that will involve an evidentiary hearing and potential liability takes place? And that's our position, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Collins. Mr. Christensen, thank you. Case is submitted.